Money FM 89.3, best of your money. Read with Michelle Martin.
Today we're reading Confronting COVID-19, a strategic playbook for leaders and decision makers. It's huge in scope in just 277 pages. This book seems to have examined almost every possible dimension of life impacted by COVID-19. It raises questions and provides recommendations in the realm of public health and governance and raises many critical questions about a future being shaped in real time. I think it's ultimately a very hopeful book, but let's find out more with the book's author, Devadas Krishnadas, CEO of Future Moves, a consultancy with a focus on public policy, and the man behind the book that we're looking through this morning. Welcome, Devadas.
Welcome, indeed. Thank you very much, Michelle, for having me on your show.
Well, thank you for joining us. So the book was published back in October 2020, and so much is still developing about the pandemic. So I think even in the preface, the writer of your preface questions whether it's premature to put a book out of this nature. Why did you want to publish such a book at this time?
Well, it's very important to be able to get some answers early when you have a crisis of such scale and such scope. I think we are already at a point where we can see what the broad parameters and the major challenges are. What is changing is, of course, the numbers, and those continue to accumulate. And they're primarily accumulating in countries which have poor governance responses to the crisis. And the central thesis of the book is that when you're dealing with crisis, whether it's financial crisis or social crisis or pandemic crisis, in this case, a pandemic crisis has a multiple dimensions to it. It has economic, financial, and political and social consequences. It's not merely a public health issue. Central to being able to respond effectively is the quality of governance. And I think it's important to stress that in this book, I emphasize governance, not just government. Mm-hmm. In other words, the response has to be more than simply government. It has to be communities and enterprises as well. And an example would be, for instance, the COVAX initiative. And just yesterday, it was announced that they were going to take responsibility for distributing 2 billion doses of the vaccine when it becomes available. Now, the COVAX initiative is not a government-led initiative. It's coordinated by the WHO, yeah. But it brings together private companies and philanthropists and research institutes in a way that we have never seen happen before. And it's a workaround the problem of the vacancy of global leadership that used to be provided by the United States, but which under Donald Trump, has not only been a vacuum on the international level, but has also been a vacuum at the United States' own national level. And hence, you see the United States having one of the highest rates of infection and also the highest fatality rate, which is ironic, given that it's the world's largest economy and the largest superpower.
Okay, several themes there, and we're going to pick up on U.S. leadership and the distribution of the vaccine in just a bit. But I want to start at the title of the book, which I think sets up expectations for your readers. So what would a business leader be able to take from an examination of a book, for example, that talks about country case studies, government's responses to their experiences? How does that relate to a leader's experience of strategic decision-making?
Well, I think we have to make very clear that there are businesses of different scales will have a different utility or find different utility from the books. Businesses which are transnational and multinationals are in a better position to take advantage of the recommendations in the book because they are sizable, they have a distribution across many countries. They have, as business leaders, to price the risk of how they are running their businesses and make decisions organizationally, make decisions in terms of their inventories, in terms of their supply chain, and how they want to work with their counterparties. Business leaders of very small companies are essentially price takers of the realities around them. They are in very little control of their own situation. And this is why SMEs in particular, and micro SMEs especially, are so highly vulnerable in a crisis of this nature, not only in the case of Singapore, but all around the world. And this is where you see the greatest amount of economic disruption taking place. It's actually in the substrata of the economy where micro SMEs and SMEs are concentrated, not at the commanding heights of the economy where these companies are. They have the greater resiliency, they have the greater potency to be able to resource counteractions, and they also have the greater ability to price the risk of COVID into their calculations and therefore, I think, continue operations in a way that has allowed them to return to a higher degree of normalcy in terms of business operations than small businesses have been able to do.
Okay, so the book was published in October this year in the midst of an evolving situation. For example, there's been a lot of positive vaccine news in recent weeks. How do you expect the situation to evolve from here when it comes to the equitable distribution of a vaccine amidst possible monopolistic pricing, limited resources, nationalistic distribution? What do you see ahead?
Well, I think it's important we don't rely on news. There is a lot of positive news, but these vaccines are still in trial. So none for deployment. And so it's important to manage expectations. Nevertheless, this is good news, especially good news that multiple vaccines have been showing positive results. Mm-hmm. And that's also important because it means that there moves the concentration risk on relying on a particular vaccine, which the virus can develop an immunity against quite rapidly, and also avoid the possibility of nationalist tendencies such as under the Trump administration of essentially using regulatory action to prioritize the United States over all other countries. So having a number of vaccines show positive results is an important feature in how we're going to deal with the crisis in 2021. Secondly, I think it's important that we have people who are thinking about the funding implications of essentially immunizing the entire global population. Not just in advanced economies, but in poor economies, which don't have the fiscal space to be able to afford the vaccine. And so initiatives such as COVAX, which is a WHO coordinated with philanthropists, research institutes, and so on, become essential in trying to address the problem of funding and also address the problem of logistics and prioritization and also deployment. Because, for instance, a Pfizer vaccine requires super cool conditions for it to remain viable. And that's very difficult logistically to be able to provide in developing countries, particularly in hot climates and rural regions, whereas it's relatively easier to do in urban concentrations in advanced economies. So there are challenges with each vaccine, especially if those vaccines require booster shots, which means that your logistical challenges and your cost challenges multiply than if you had a vaccine which was a one-shot silver bullet. But it's highly likely that almost all vaccines will require booster shots.
So I ask about the vaccine distribution because in your book, you outline possibilities. You have long-term forecast models for global growth. You talk about a cooperative model, an antagonistic world, the possibility of a fragmented world, So what is your reading of vaccine developments as they stand now? Are they giving you any signals in terms of which of your long-term forecasts for global growth could pan out?
Well, I think the most important development in recent weeks has been the winning of the U.S. general election by Joe Biden, who is now president-elect, even though President Donald Trump has not officially ceded the election to him. But I think that that is inevitability. He's already authorized the GSA, the Government Services Administration, to begin the transition process. Now, the reason why that's the most important development is because the president-elect Joe Biden is committed to multilateralism. You will recall that under Donald Trump, the United States pulled out of the WHO and also withdrew $400 million of annual funding, which represented the largest chunk of national contributions to the WHO at the height of the crisis. I think he will restore that. He will rejoin the WHO. He will work with the international community to ensure that the United States is once again playing its global leadership role and try to be a positive force in getting cooperation and coordination so that not only will vaccine development be accelerated, but there's adequate planning and provisioning for the logistics of distribution and also the filling of the funding gap. In which case, he'll be working quite closely with not only WHO, but with the World Bank and the IMF and UNICEF, all of which have financing reserves that will make possible the accessibility and affordability of vaccines by countries which don't have internal fiscal capacity to do so.
Readers, you're listening to Devadas Krishnadas. He's CEO of Futures Moves, and he's also author of the book that we're reading today, Confronting COVID-19, A Strategic Playbook for Leaders and Decision Makers. So picking up on the Biden presidency, your book predicts the end of U.S. leadership on the global stage and predicts that the U.S. will come to be viewed as a risk instead. So does the Biden presidency change that?
No, it doesn't. A swallow doesn't make a summer. And unfortunately, I think throughout the 20 years of the 21st century, what we've seen is the U.S. leadership, particularly executive leadership, George H.W. Bush launching a war based on a false premise, a failed war in Iraq, President Obama essentially being hamstrung by Congress and not being able to get any of his international treaties ratified. And then, of course, Donald Trump, who's the ultimate nationalist and America first, make America great again. So America has lost a tremendous amount of political credibility on the international stage. And Joe Biden will have to work very hard at rebuilding that. What has also happened is a loss of credibility in the American system, because once a system produces a leader such as in the character of Donald Trump, it can do so again. And what is also observable is that in the recent presidential election, almost 48% of Americans voted for Donald Trump. So there was not a blue wave as people expected, certainly Democrats expected, in winning the general election. So yes, he did win by the Electoral College and he did win the popular vote, but almost half of Americans didn't vote for him. And this was at a time when there was the highest voters turnout in living memory in the U.S. general election. So I think we have to have very managed expectations of the Biden presidency. He might want to enter into treaties or rejoin treaties such as the TPP, the Paris Climate Agreement, rejoin the WHO, but he may not be allowed to do so by a Senate that is controlled still by the Republic, especially when it's led by Mitch McConnell. So it's important to understand that that's more form than substance in the American presidency's ability to, American president's ability to restore American credibility globally.
I want to bring the discussion back home. Your book is very wide-ranging. I want to ask how you expect Singapore to be able to transform our economy for the future, because it looks like we're still very much invested in the idea of being a node in business value chains or supply chains, and that involves openness to the world. So if Singapore's model of economic revival relies on being open to the world, what does this mean for our medium and long-term economic growth prospects? I mean, the Hong Kong-Singapore travel bubble has been delayed for 2 weeks, highlighting just some of the ongoing difficulties involved in opening borders.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I expect that that delay of 2 weeks will be extended to more than 4 to 6 weeks, because the clusters number is rising in Hong Kong, not falling. So people who have bought tickets, I think, are going to be disappointed. But to address your question more directly, I think this is what is keeping our Prime Minister and his cabinet up awake at night, every night. There is no silver bullet. There is no easy answer. Our entire raison d'etre as an economy has been on the basis of trade. That was why Raffles establishing Singapore as a trading post. We are still relevant globally. We are part of the global supply chain. We are a critical node. We have for the last 30 years pursued what is called a multiple hub strategy. So we have a tremendous amount of sunk costs in all of those economic strategies, and we have no alternative to them at this point in time. One of the challenges that the COVID crisis has thrown up is that it's allowed businesses to explore different ways of organizationally working. And they've come to the conclusion, especially in MNCs, that they don't necessarily need to have a large hub in Singapore. They can have a hub-light approach and have a lot of people working in other places. It also helps them avoid concentration risk. And so I think Singapore comes out of this situation in a more compromised position than it would like to be. And we will have to find new and novel ways to make ourselves relevant in a post-COVID world, when our historical and conventional strategies have diminished effectiveness. And one of the ways that we will be and have to do that is essentially start to look at GNI rather than GDP as our measure of success. And let me explain that GDP is a measure of goods and services produced domestically whereas GNI or GNP is goods and services produced by Singapore registered or owned companies anywhere in the world. And I think that requires our businesses, not only government-linked businesses, but all businesses to accelerate internationalization, to be present in larger markets, so that even when we are compromised economically, we are still being able to depend on the repatriation of profits from these externalized businesses, business operations back into the Singapore economy. I think that's going to be a very important source of resiliency going forward.
Well, speaking of resilience, what do you think has been Singapore's greatest lesson in terms of handling the COVID pandemic to date, and how can we learn from it?
Well, I think credit has to be given to the government. We have seen that the last cluster has closed effectively yesterday, and we've had more than 2 weeks of zero community cases. So they have succeeded. And our fatality rate is the lowest in the world, which is a very important point to emphasize, because it was not a result of an overnight decision. It was actually a reflection of decisions made post-SARS to invest in building up human capital capability in epidemiology and infectious diseases, and to build a very new National Infectious Disease Institute, which actually coincidentally just opened last year in November, just in time for the crisis. And so we had capacity because we made decisions over the long term, almost 2 decades ago in 2003. And that's a reflection of Singapore's ability to think long term, to make hard decisions, and to put money behind them and see them through, which is a result of our political stability and continuity. However much people might have discomfort about the fact that we're a single party government for the last 55 years, it has proven its worth to date. Whether that continues to be the case remains to be seen. One can't have a crystal ball and foresee the future. But that's a very important lesson to take away, that ability to be strategic and to be structured, to be systemic and to be sustained is a big explanation for why we've been successful. However, it's also important to note that we made mistakes. And one of the mistakes we made, ironically, is a result of our success in dealing with SARS. We developed the SARS playbook. I was involved as Secretary of the Interministerial Committee, which managed the SARS crisis in 2003. And we developed a SARS playbook, which was our pandemic plan. And in the early months of the year, that seemed to actually be making a tremendous amount of success, because our numbers were very low and we were referred to as a gold standard. But that was in February 2020. By March, or mid of March 2020, we went from gold standard to no standard, because we had a huge explosion within the foreign worker population. And so what that proves is that it's important to have a plan, but it's important not to stick with the plan and assume that the assumptions made in that plan hold true under future crisis, but be able to adapt quickly and be alert to signals that are being sent that the next crisis has some features which are fundamentally different than the previous one, and be able to respond preemptively to that as information becomes available. I think we waited too long. We stayed with the old plan too long. And by the time we reacted, we had gone from, as I say, gold standard to no standard. But then all our other crisis capability management, deep depth in those capabilities have kicked in. And I think that's why you see that we are now in a much more favorable position.
Well, at the end of the book, you talk about building a better world in the age of technology, where you say control over technology and those who control it determines where authority lies. So what are the most troubling and perhaps the most hopeful dimensions as well of building a future in what you term a Blade Runner world?
Yes, I think it's important to look beyond the COVID-19 and not just be obsessed by it. It may take 2 to 3 years to get there, but what certainly we are seeing as a result of COVID-19 is acceleration under the adoption of technology by individuals, by governments, and by corporations. It's actually taking us closer to a world which we were already heading in the direction of, and it's changing the way we communicate, it's changing the way we relate to each other, it's changing the way we do business, and we are not going to be unwinding that acceleration. We are essentially going to continue on that path and continue to pick up on that. What that implies is that technology platform owners, and many of these are now natural monopolies such as Facebook or Google and so on, have a tremendous amount of influence in the way the world operates in a way that governments used to have or international organizations at the UN used to have. Now you have technology companies which have more information than governments have and which have the capacity to mine that information, analyze that information, curate that information, and essentially influence the political milieu and the social perspectives of governments where they have no sovereign authority and where they have no regulatory restraint. So the challenge from a governance point of view coming out of the COVID crisis is governments have to work together to come up with transnational regulatory frameworks to restrict these natural monopolies in a way that extracts the best value out of them, but also contains their less malevolent tendencies.
Well, it's a fascinating discussion and such a wide-ranging book, Forensic in Detail. The book we've been talking about today is Confronting COVID-19, a Strategic Playbook for Leaders and Decision Makers. And you just heard Devadas Krishnadas, author and CEO of Futures Moves, here with me on Read. Devadas, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day.
You too.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg. Or download the SPH Radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.